compared to what Usain Bolt does with short distances and what weight Van Eekel does with 400 meters. We have learned two things from them. The one is that in politics, we are also running a race. And in this race, we also have certain rules. And the rules is not to rob. So we've had our local government election, and there were rules. And I don't think that anybody robbed. I think we need to be proud as legislators, as members of parliament in this country, of how the IEC has managed to provide us with an election that is free and fair. And we are wishing our negotiators well, as today is the final day to deal with the conditions and the mandates. It is going to be a very interesting era in our democracy as we look at what comes out of that process. Depending upon how one looks at it, I think that our democracy is maturing. And I'm sure that that is something on which we have consensus. I want to welcome today the two colleagues from the Department of Trade and Industry. Honourable members, the two matters that we're going to deal with today is the SADC and EU Economic Partnership Agreement, or what we call the SADC EU EPA. And then we are also going to deal with the National Gambling Policy. It's a policy for 2016. I will speak more to it. No, I think we're starting with the National Gambling Policy, so let me speak to it now. We do know there has been lots of rigorous engagement on this policy during the processing of the policy in the National Assembly. And there have been public hearings on that, particularly on the question of internet gambling. And we want to introduce policy on that to say how exactly will we ensure that it is implementable, whatever comes out of the policy. The Department of Trade and Industry will present to us today that policy document to kick off with. And we have the Deputy Director General, Mr. Lubi Peter, who is going to do the presentation on the EPA, but we'll start off first with Mr. Who is doing the presentation on the gambling policy. Megama? Which one are you doing? Oh, you're doing the gambling. That's what I thought, because the document before us says that Mr. Mashamaide, who is the director of the gambling policy and law. So we have the two of you then doing that presentation. And we have our own friend, our old friend, Nikki, who will do the EPA. William? Sorry, Honorable Faber. You see, if you know Nikki and you travel abroad, then you are definitely in good hands. Right. Nikki, thank you very much, Nikki. That you are more to us than just staff member in DTI, but you also look after us in a consistent manner when we are on strange shores and very often feel that we need intelligent insights on complex matters. So let me hand over to our colleagues from DTI, honorable members, the agenda. Sorry, before we do that, the agenda that we're going to have is we're going to have one presentation first on gambling policy, then have questions and answers on that. Then we're going to have the second, which is the EU Partnership Agreement, have discussion on that. Then we're going to look at the document that we looked at yesterday, which is the oversight draft program, and we're also going to look at our draft program for this quarter for adoption by the meeting. And then we can close our business for the day. So, please, our colleagues in detail.
Thanks, Chair. I'm McDonald in Extend, coming from the DTI. I've got my colleague, Mashamaite, and Wimbani. I will do the presentation in a form of introduction and the conclusion, but Mashamaite, through your chair, will do the presentation, the full presentation. This one is given to a self-briefing the select committee. Then I will talk to this by way of introduction is that as you may recall, in South Africa there was South Africa, apartheid South Africa, there was no gambling allowed. So there was no gambling allowed, and then gambling was allowed in the Bantustan, the TBVC. So the rationale was to protect the South African citizens, white South Africans. But the gambling was dumped in the Bantustan to the blacks. So the reason was to protect the citizens of South Africa. Yeah. I'm emphasizing that point, to protect the citizens of South Africa, but it's South Africa, and dumped it to the banks in the TDGC space. So the government appointed a commission led by Professor Vian Commission, and then they recommended to allow gambling, but it must be regulated in a strict manner. It must be regulated in a strict manner because we are dealing with harmful activity. So there are certain people who say, why can't you allow people of 18 years onwards to gamble? Because they can enter into a contract, they can sign marriage contracts, all those issues. Here we are dealing with something that is harmful to the society. It can kill. And so much that one day, if all of us we are gambling, we may find ourselves addicted, and therefore we are reduced into sort of a rubble, mentally speaking. So the VR Commission recommended, and then I'm moving to the right side clockwise. The National Gambling Act of 1996 was passed, and then it introduced the National Gambling Board to regulate. And then further, in 2004, National Gambling Act amended 1996, the National Gambling Policy Council to ensure policy alignment at national and provincial level. If I may explain here, because gambling is a matter of common jurisdiction with provinces. Provinces regulate gambling through licensing, the casinos and the like, and then also at national level, we have the gambling board for, say, central monitoring what is happening on the ground. So, because of the issue of common jurisdiction for competency, there was a need to form a policy council that is consisting of the minister and the counterparts at provincial level, that is trade and MECs on trade. And then we also have in 2008 National Gambling Amendment Act that was passed, that was to introduce an interactive gambling. However, the act was signed by the president, but it was not proclaimed. In other words, the regulations and proclamations were not done. We'll explain later. So it is an act of parliament. Probably it will be repealed by the one that is coming. And then I'm in the Gambling Review Commission report. There was a lot of demand, like introduce the issue of remote gambling, dog racing, cockerel fighting, pigeon race, and the like. So the minister said it would be better to establish a study group of eminent people. But here I will refer to it as a commission, but it's not a commission in terms of a commission act. It's called Gambling Review Commission, and then it did recommendation to the minister, and then the minister also tabled the report in cabinet, and it also went to the Trade and Industry Portfolio Committee and to the Select Committee, debating such. That enabled the department to sit down and analyze and come with a policy, draft policy. And the draft policy, it was engaged with stakeholders, and then later on the 17th of February 2016, the final policy was adopted by cabinet. And then this policy, therefore, is the one that we are going to present now. And then the policy will also go to the extent of informing a big gambling amendment bill that will come also to this house. So without wasting time, I will request my colleague, Mashamayete, to continue with the body of the presentation. Thank you, Chair.
Morning, honorable members. As indicated, my name is Ngwadi Mashamayete from the Department of Trade and Industry. So I'm going to take you through the policy statement that came up in the National Gambling Policy and approved by the Cabinet. Now, the first was to consider the status of the National Gambling Policy Council, which is a policy coordinating body comprised of minister and MECs responsible for gambling in each province. The effectiveness of the forum has always been a sore point in that there was always lack of quorum when the meetings are supposed to take place, and as a result, important decisions could not be taken. In order to address this issue of the no quorum, the policy has proposed now that the meetings should take place, and if two meetings consecutively do not have a quorum, the best one should be able to make binding decisions on those issues that were not considered in the previous two meetings that were had. So this basically allows that a meeting that does not have a quorum should be able to make binding decisions. And the other issue was the issue of policy alignment in provinces. We've seen some provinces actually introducing some gambling activities that were not, that there was no initial policy direction on, and as a result we found that provinces they actually amend their legislation, whereas national when we amend legislation we go to the policy council, provinces don't go to the policy council with their policy. So we, the policy indicated that provinces and national must all submit their policies before the national policy council in order to ensure that there is no misalignment of policy. Nationally, we should actually not stick with contradictory policy direction to the industry. So policy and legislation must be consulted on at the national implement policy council. And then the next one was on the National Emblem Board. The issue was the status of the board. We all found that it was inefficient, at most in taking decisions in performing its function in terms of the legislation. And it has been resolved that we should actually establish the National Emblem Regulator, which will now only be headed by the Chief Executive Officer. There will no longer be a board structure to manage the National Gambling Regulator. And this was just to ensure that there is the inefficiencies are addressed in dealing with the gambling issues nationally. And there is also an issue of unlawful winnings that the National Gambling Board is mandated to collect. This is the money where somebody is excluded from gambling, or they actually won but they are underage, those things, they could choose unlawful winnings. The money is actually supposed to be collected and be forfeited to the state after the court order is sought to that effect. And then we have considered that the issue of approaching the court comes with a huge expense, and we might be seeking to forfeit very small amount of money that was won, and at a very huge cost. So we came up with a proposal that unlawful winning should actually be automatically forfeited without the need of a court order, because in any way it would have been established that this money is unlawful winning, and that money should actually be utilized to address the issue of redress in through the National Responsible Gambling Program, which is a body that offers rehabilitation counseling to problem gamblers. So it should no longer be forfeited to the state, maybe to the National Revenue Fund. And the mandate of the National Gambling Board will be emphasized to say that they should implement education and awareness, implement measures to combat illegal gambling, offer treatment, actually work with a treatment body to ensure that this mandate is actually reaching everybody, and to also manage the operation of the central monitoring system without outsourcing it to private interest. The National Central Electronic Monitoring System is a system used to monitor the limited payout machines. These are slot machines that we are allowed to be licensed outside casinos. They are found mostly in pubs where we allow a minimum of 5 machines, but an application can be made to help those machines increase maybe to up to 40 machines per site. The Central Electronic Monitoring System is a monitoring tool just to ensure that money that is spent on the gambling is actually accounted for in terms of calculating tax, and also to monitor that these machines are working properly, they do not pose any harm to gamblers themselves. And then in relation to casinos, we noted that the VN Commission recommended that the location of casinos should actually be remote from residential area. We remember casinos like Carondale was actually in the outskirts But now residences are building up around this casino. Even the carousel now is actually near residential place. But the envisaged program was to ensure that people travel to casinos in order to allow them time to think when they are going there, whether they really want to go there and they really can afford to spend what they have allocated. But now it is very close. You just get out of the gate and turn a casino. And then this thing is actually exacerbated even by need to relocate casinos. We have seen Murula San, the proposal now is to relocate it into the city center to near Main Lane Mall, in fact within Main Lane Mall in Pretoria. We have actually proposed that, given the fact that now developments are occurring around the casinos, they should actually continue to maintain different current existence in terms of their entrances and exits. They should not actually be mixed with the rest of the activities around. And the relocation of casinos must always actually emphasize that initial proposal that casinos should be located remotely. They should not just be brought into the middle of busy areas. And in relation to bingo, bingo was permitted to be played either in casinos or outside. And what we had then when this policy of 2004 National Gambling Act was implemented, we had paper type, we call it traditional form of bingo now. That is where people are playing with cards, that game of bingo. But in 2004, we have seen the introduction of slot type of machines called electronic bingo terminals. And there's been a lot of argument around those which ended up in court, where we as national and some casino operators felt that the electronic bingo terminals are just slot machines, and they were not supposed to be permitted outside casino venues. And the court actually concurred that indeed they are slot machines and they were not supposed to be permitted. But after that judgment, we have seen provinces amending their legislations now to actually accommodate the definition of to include electronic form of bingo. And as a result, there's been call from us at National that let's rather have a structured policy in terms of how electronic bingo should be regulated, because gambling, in terms of the recommendations of the VR Commission, should be regulated with limitations and strict control. And limitations means that we cannot just allow it as a free kind of business that can operate anywhere because of the harms associated with it. So we felt that we need to have a national policy framework in order for that. But we have seen provinces also coming up with their own, despite our calls even as the National Gambling Policy Council, where they participate as well. And as a result, the policy now proposes that where when we allow EBT, as we call them, electronic betting terminals, we should emphasize that there should be limitations on numbers of seats per venue, the province and nationally. How many machines do we want to be allocated per venue nationally and per province? And these numbers that are permitted can be reviewed by a minister from time to time whenever there is motivation for that. And we also feel that we should not actually remove the paper type of bingo altogether. They should be allocated together, maybe on a 60-40% basis per venue, in the sense that we will have 40% in the electronic bingo terminal and the 60% going to the tables for the traditional form of bingo. The other issue is horse racing. Currently, the policy is we are regulating the betting form of gambling on where horse racing is concerned. We do not regulate the sport itself for racing, and a number of other aspects, including the breeding and the training of the horses. But there has come a number of issues that we felt that there is a need for us to also focus in that area as well. Because if we do not actually participate in regulating how the sport is conducted, we might actually not be able to control the results of the betting, because there might be collusion in terms of how a race is conducted, where there can be manipulation. As a result, the betting results will be affected, which is our gambling part as well. But there are also smaller stakeholders within who are employees who we feel are also exploited, and because we do not participate at that level, we are not able to call for their protection as well. In this particular, we are referring to the issue of the groups who participate there. There are reported abuses there, physical and verbal, and in some instances, we have not been able to assist those people, and they are the vulnerable stakeholder within the industry. So that is why we feel that we should also enter that terrain and regulate the sporting. But we have recognized that the sport of horse racing was always under self-regulation body, under the National Horse Racing Regulatory Authority, which the National Horse Racing Authority is actually monitoring how the breeding is done. They also monitor the actual race in terms of how it is done. But we know also that the people who participate in the NHA are the ones who own those horses. They are the ones who actually offer betting as well. So the issue of independence of that body is actually questionable. So that we have actually opted that we should only license the National Gambling Regulator, empower the National Regulator, National Gambling Regulator, to monitor the operations of the self-regulation body or of the whole racing sector, and see to it that they are doing things above board. Everything that is done is actually above board. And this will also assist in ensuring the credibility of the race, and that there is fair treatment for all participants within there. And we might also assist in dealing with horse racing and other activities and proteins in the horse racing sector, which were not recognized before, and the interest for betting on those activities. On the betting sector, again, there is a stakeholder called Bookmakers. Bookmakers is some independent organizations which offer bets on almost everything that can be bet on. They bet on horses, they bet on soccer, they also take bets on the lottery results as well. So Bookmakers, there's always been clashes between Bookmakers and the racing operators who are offering truth betting. In that they will actually offer open bets on the results of the racing operator, in terms of saying we'll pay you the dividend that is paid by the tote system. In summary, the tote system is what the horse racing operators, we are referring to Pumerela, Gold Cycle and Kenilworth, when they take bets, they put them in the form of a pool in terms of those categories of bets. And the tote system, when it is done, they will also show the dividends that will be paid in terms of how many people bet in each category and everything. So Bookmakers offer bets and guarantee to pay what the tote system will pay for that bet. The horse racing operators feel that this is their trade intellectual property that should be compensated for using being used. And they also feel that Bookmakers, when they take bets on horse racing, they should also contribute towards the development of horse racing. But what is currently the practice is that Bookmakers pay 6% on tax that they retain from the winnings that people pay to people. So if a person bets between a bookmaker and they win, they retain 6%. Which will be paid in a form of tax to the provincial regulator. And that 6%, 3% of which will be paid back to the horse racing operator. And I mentioned this with the disclaimer that the three provinces which feel that they are not obliged to pay back the 3% to the operating operator. And those provinces are Limpopo, Mpumalanga and Northwest. Even the grounds that they will not actually train horses, they don't breed horses, they are not offering any race course in their area, so they don't need to contribute towards that activity. But the horse racing operators feel that the amount is not sufficient. They feel bookmakers should be contributing the 6% from their own gross gambling revenue that they have received. And the debates are actually continuing in that regard. In the policy, we are saying that if there is an issue of intellectual property rights that needs to be respected, the laws of intellectual property should assist them in dealing with that. But in the event there is any activity that must be paid for, is a product that belongs to another operator there, there should be payment towards that. But if they cannot be agreed, be a reasonable agreement, provincial licensing authorities should assist in determining the payable rate. We eventually proposed this in order to ensure that the purpose is not to get rid of the bookmakers in the industry, and this should not be used to eliminate the competition of bookmakers from the industry. And that's why we feel that a fair process is when the regulator will determine that amount that should be paid towards the development of horse racing. And there should also be clarity on what the 3% paid to horse racing operators is actually intended for. It should not be used to pay dividends to the shareholders, for example. And still on bookmakers, we felt that it is actually wrong for them to take bets on lottery results, because lottery is a competence of the national authority called the National Lotteries Commission, and that should not be tampered with, because this body has been created to ensure that there is enough funds to fund good cause organizations. And when there is this undue competition, revenue is lost to those bookmakers who are taking bets. And then, given the fact that there is demand on that and it's already established, we said that, okay, we can't just get rid of it altogether. So we rather opted that they should actually be licensed by the National Lottery Commission. And the National Lottery Commission, the National Lottery Board, so, is the one that is responsible for the National Lottery Distribution Trust Fund. And if they are licensed there, there will also be a determination that on the revenue they generate from betting on lotteries activities, they should pay towards the National Lottery Distribution Trust Fund, so that could cause benefits from their activity. And this also includes the three total operators, Pumelela Gold Cycle and Kenilworth, because they also offer pool betting on sports outside horse racing, including soccer, rugby, and other sporting activities. And this was supposed to fall under the terrain of the lottery commission. So we are also saying that where that is concerned, where there is sports pools on other sporting activities, they should also be licensed by the National Lottery Distribution the National Lottery Commission. And the minister will determine a rate that they should pay and publish it in the gazette. And we also addressed the issue of greyhound racing, because in 2009, the DTI received a report, commissioned a study, which actually looked into dog racing. But this current policy pronounced on it that, considering the welfare issues, problem gambling that we have, that actually is growing trend, and the weaknesses in enforcement, we think that we should not allow dog racing in the current state. And then the activity will remain illegal, and enforcement to ensure that it remains illegal will be improved. The same goes to online gambling. Online gambling is also another activity that is really a bit of a challenge to us. And we are concerned about our own brick and mortar license operators, casinos, who have already generated significant employment, contributed a lot in infrastructure development, entertainment sector is benefiting a lot in that regard. So we felt that online gambling is bringing that a new challenge, and we should actually improve our enforcement improve our relations with other stakeholders, that we ensure that banks close their accounts, the operators of those online gambling don't have bank accounts, the local internet service providers that do not offer hosting to this site, so we should not have a site that is offered through our internet service providers. And then we have noted that that actually will require our regulators to work and actually notify those about who is illegal, and so that they can be closed up in the banks and their internet as well. And if any of the service providers does not close down the account or the internet site, they should be prosecuted for that. I will get that too.
No, thanks. By way of conclusion, is that we are seeing the country has got a lot of ills. Over indebtedness, as an example, credit in the area of finance. Over indebtedness is a problem. Liquor is also a problem. It has got a lot of ills that it comes with. And therefore, when we have to regulate gambling, it is in that pack that we need to consider it cumulatively and then take a policy decision. And cabinet has agreed that let's regulate gambling in a strict manner. And then implementation is a problem. Mashamait has already said that. And then let's put systems in place, whether it's for online or remote gambling. You still remember that there was a private member's bill that deals with remote gambling. Remote gambling was to an extent of saying all forms of gambling should be offered in an electronic fashion, whether it's dog racing, fuzzy, you name them, pigeon, cockroach fighting, whilst we're saying the citizens of South Africa are going to pull very hard. And then we also talk about the issue of harmonization of this regulation. If provinces are pulling to a different direction, we are running one government with three tiers of government. In so many that therefore we must have common policy, uniform, without encroaching in the mandate of other people. In other words, let me repeat myself. We have government nationally given powers in terms of the constitution. Province, constitution gives power. Local government, constitution gives power. A good example, let's say Liquor. If the outlets are just mushrooming everywhere, to exaggerate, there can be a problem if national says, let us not have these outlets next to schools, as an example, because they're nuisance. Because next to churches, there are nuisance, as an example, and therefore next to residential areas, there are nuisance, as an example. But you find that the bylaws by the municipalities, we don't have even a uniform standard of town planning to say we are moving to this direction. So therefore, when we talk about harmonization, we should do it within the confines of the constitution. So we should not be blamed that we want to undermine the constitution. No, that is not the issue. So the other issue that I may say in passing is that there is a problem of bookmakers that are playing lotto, allowing lotto two numbers you can win more than the three numbers that you win in the national lotto. And therefore, money is being digressed to other issues. It's no longer going to good causes, as in this. But Mr. Maida has explained, I was just giving an example that money is going somewhere, no longer channeled to good causes. In closing, is that the cabinet took a decision that we should not longer have other forms of gambling. Let us emphasize the issue of enforcement. When we talk about enforcement, we know that on online gambling, people should maybe see in Europe, in this country, it is happening, but we have done the benchmark. So the enforcement that we are talking about is also covering areas of a foreign jurisdiction, as an example. With those few words, Chair, I would like to hand over the key to you. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Mr. Nishichenze and Mr. Machambi, Mr. Mahetki. I decided not to rush you in the presentation, honorable members, because it is a very important policy that we need to look at. We know what is happening in our communities with regard to gambling, and it stretches also across the class divide in our communities, that we find poor people taking their large money in gambling, and we find richer people taking big amounts rather than putting it in the economy, taking a chance and huge losses to the fiscus occurs in the process. And I thought, let us allow them to go through that. I could notice at the end and also at certain other phases or stages in the representation as well that there are great interest from members. So let us now allow you to raise the questions that you have. But honorable members, before we do that, allow me to just do something that I forgot when we started the meeting. It's to render the apology of two members. We have a written apology from Honorable Lingen and also a written apology from Honorable Dihale. Honorable Dihale is in the house, but he's attending a meeting, the budget oversight meeting that's happening there in Old Assembly Chamber. That being done, can I then ask you that we take maybe three questions in a round? I noticed the head of Honorable Father, Honorable Ntebe, and Honorable Nita. Now, because of the dynamics in the provinces, I need to just inform the two presenters that Honorable Father is from Northern Cape. He doesn't speak here on behalf of Northern Cape only. He's a national representative, but he's deployed here by the Northern Cape Provincial Legislature. Honorable Ntebe is from the popular one, Northwest. And then Honorable Nita is from the Eastern Cape. Now, I haven't gone to the Eastern Cape, so I don't know whether there are casinos there. I would assume in the Botswana area there would be casinos there as well. Okay, so now you would be able to understand where they're coming from when they pose questions, although their questions may not relate to the province they're coming from. Honourable Father.
Thank you, Chair, and thanks for the presentation. Chairperson, yes, I want to quickly start, if we look on page 5 of the policy position on the money collected as unlawful winnings. I would like to have a clear indication and definition on unlawful winnings that should be automatically forfeited without court order paid over international responsible gambling. Now, I need to understand, if something is unlawful, it must first be determined by courts, as far as I understand. I cannot see that it can be unlawful without a court seeing if it is unlawful. That is how my understanding of the law is. This is why we on the rechtsstaat. So something must be first unlawful in court before it can become unlawful. I want to know, how do you determine the unlawful winnings here? To me, that is the first thing. Then the second part, on internet gambling, and then I'm specifically also talking about this giant lotto that you can play overseas, giant lottos and sport, betting, etc. Now, I understand there are people with gambling problems, but if that is a problem, we should stop gambling altogether. Then we should not have gambling at all. If there is an internet, we cannot pass the internet. It was always there. It always starts to be in the new generation of people. I think it should just be regulated, perhaps, in a way. We cannot wish internet away. It's not going to go away. And you can somehow try, like in Dubai, to regulate the internet in a way, but there will always be someone else that finds out some new way to almost hack it and go on again. So by saying we stop internet betting, I don't think that is the way. I think there should be a type of a regulation how to define who is going to gamble, for instance, going online. But you cannot all and all say we stop internet gambling. That will not help. I can tell you now, you are fighting a losing battle. You will never win the people on the electronic side. There will always be one in front of you. So the best I can just say is somehow regulate it and somehow find a way to actually see if the right people get on the... And I think that is first, my first round. Thank you, Chair.
Chair, Honourable Taylor.
Chair, I'm going to try to club the issue around functionality of the board and the powers conferred to the MEC and the minister in one. That I try to see that you are looking into the problems there. Impacting on the functionality of the board. But I don't see that tangibly what you are suggesting here would be an ultimate closure of the issue that you are raising. Like, for instance, where I would want to assume that you have provisions within the constitutions that are governing the board, that probably when you don't attend such threshold of meetings, you get disqualified from being a board member. But in the functionality of the board, if the boards are not functional, and we are giving their responsibility to the MEC and the minister, what does then become the judiciary duty responsibility of the board members? Are we not negatively impacting on that? Because to be appointed as a board member, you are then conferred a judicial responsibility to exercise legislative and all those powers that are given to you. And if you are saying the MEC in the absence of a quorum, the second meeting can take a decision, regardless of the third meeting correcting, what are the implications thereof? Are we rather not, in essence, disbanding or impacting negatively on the functionalities of the board, though we want to assist? The second issue is that, yes, quite explicitly you have identified that the board is not functional. But here, there's nothing that you suggest that is going to assist the board to be functional. We're just saying that the board must be able to, and it's a necessary intervention I want to obey, where you're saying that there must be an alignment of policy formulation within the provinces and nation. And I think we must agree with that, Chair. It's a necessary intervention that needs to happen so that there's alignment in terms of what needs to happen. The other issue here that I want to raise is I understand where you come from in terms of the forfeiting of the dividends. I want to assume that Honorable Baba knows that when you're underage, you can't be employed. When you have been disqualified and you have been declared, I don't know whether you call it insolvent or you call it what, you are under rehabilitation, you are barred from gambling. So I want to assume that we want to have economic spin-offs from gambling part of it. We don't want to stop it and criminalize it, but we have always been explicit to say we want to encourage responsible gambling. And this is what we need to do. The challenge, however, is that we are a constitutional democracy. So the rule of law is very important to us. And in this country, the final arbiters of legality are courts. And when you are going to take dividends because I do not qualify age-wise. And I want to challenge it. You are still going to have a challenge because final arbiters of legality is a court here. I understand, Mr. Jens, that you don't, sometimes you want to chase 200 and you are going to spend 200,000 in a court case. I mean, it does not make sense. But unfortunately, we are tied up. We are constitutional democrats.
The other issue there, as I gallop along, is the issue that, look, you are suggesting here that, and South Africa is developing very fast. Some of our friends who are not here, even, let me not be controversial.
But I'm just saying, if you took the carousel issue at the Mashamite, there's only one entrance. There's no other way that you will enter carousel in any other way. Now, if you are saying, in the face of development that we see around our own communities, we must look at the entrance, what is the practicality of doing that? I can do an example. There used to be what you call Taunzan, it's now Taunzask, in my home village. There used to be casino there before it was moved to Rio in Matlokan. The only way you could enter Taunzask was through one entrance, and there was no way that you could change it. Because there's no entrance at the back. There's nothing. If you go to Rio today, you can't change it. And if you see the development that is happening in Matlokan in terms of today, you are going to have a problem. So this suggestion that the entrance must be taken in another direction and whatever is impractical in my view. Cannot work. Unless if you are referring to even the issue about Marula San and Ninlane Mall, it's going to be dynamic. Because Ninlane Mall is stuck in the middle of the it is a northern suburb of Pretoria of the East. Yeah. How do you do it?
So it's not gonna work. But what worries me most out of this is the functionality of the budget. The last issue. What do you call it? No.
These people who are doing also getting like your lottery and what, but on your hostelry. Yeah, your bookmaker. Maybe if you are not aware that Mashamite, this is now a new phenomenon in the country. If you go to bookmaker today, there's never a day that you are not going to find queue. So it is very thoughtful of you to be thinking that let's not criminalize it. Let's rather try to regulate it in the manner that it's going to be assisted. However, they don't have a social responsibility like all others that we have regulated. And that's what we need to infuse into our legislation. Other than that, we cannot do anything. Other than that, they are going to continue to make money. They are not going to be having any social responsibility in the domain communities. They are going to be getting into the intellectual property of the other, and it's going to cause chaos. Yes. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Honorable Minister.
What are bingos? Sorry for my ignorance. I don't know what that is. I don't want to be out of this room. I don't know. So I'm very upset that I'm not having it. Upon the issue, most of the points that I wanted to talk about, they are already covered specifically by the previous speaker. But I want to flesh on the issue of unlawful criminals. Because I am picking up a gap that how to define a situation where there are unlawful winners in the area of the gambling board. Because as Honorable Minister has said, you've got eight restrictions, for instance. Is that not wonder that people that get to get in are the people of the right age? And there are those that will pass from participating because of many reasons. You don't have a system where people, when they get in, they are clear to be inside because they are not bad. They are not bad by the system of their name. So I'm thinking that is the need someone for the gambling Christians who be protected from those people that are not supposed to be Christians. And the other point, you talk of abuse because, and for instance, that is picked up that. But I didn't hear you tell me what is the commission telling you to do about that. I know that it's not your scope in my understanding. It should be something that is doing in partnership with the government of labor, because it's the responsibility of the government of labor to protect workers that are abused. So the other one to know how, what is your plan to resolve this kind of problem? And the other one, and then this gambling that is taking place throughout the country, kind of push up over the name of it, because a new name.
Triple M.
Triple M. We had you mentioning anything about it. Yet it's something that is really making people crazy. The whole country, at least in my view, does need kind of control. I know that they are not saying that this is something that's going difficult to deal with them, because they don't bend money anyway, but still, in my view, the government is a responsibility to protect the citizens from that kind of gambling that is not regulated. That point is the issue of illicit. You did mention that in Twitter that there are licenses, people they get licenses to do issues in the area where the schools are setting the level. It's still happening. And I know that you say it's not your responsibility to take things from your function. But it's a function of the municipality to develop pylons that begin to protect that. My feeling is that you are not aggressive enough with the municipality to begin to deal with this matter. Because sooner or later it's going to be very, very serious. Your sectors are complaining, schools are complaining, and even having licenses. So somewhere, somehow, there must be a clear policy from your side that talk about receiving the license the person has started trading or later next to the school, next to, you don't really rely entirely to what the local government or municipality is doing. You should be having something specific to protect our community from the situation.
I notice you, Honorable Baba. I just want to intervene and say that though it is very important, the question, your last question on liquor, I don't think it would be fair to put it here. There is a unit within DTI that's working on that. And you can get the information because there is new policy that we're looking at on that as well with the Department of Social Development. So I concur with you on the importance of it, but I think it's unfair to raise it to the two colleagues here on which you agree. Honourable Father, I see you wanted to add a last question.
Yes, sir, and actually more recommendation. You know, we were talking about yesterday of public participation, and I think specifically when it comes to gambling, we are sitting here as a committee, but there should be public hearings, I believe, all over the country. You really get the feeling of the people on the ground, how they feel about it. Because I must be quite honest, I also think there must be provincial consultation on this. It should not just be like go and a national law being just pushed onto it, because I really believe there should be a lot of public hearings on this. And I really believe we have to look at that. It's going to come back to us at the end of the day if we don't do that.
I, in my introductory comments, but the colleagues from DTI would speak on that, did indicate that there were public hearings convened by the National Assembly. I've not been part of the public hearings, but I've seen the rigor with which the participation and debate happened within those hearings when it was broadcast on television. So it has happened, but the colleagues may want to add to that if they so wish. Can I just say one thing? I test the water. I hear and notice the number of questions that you have, honorable members. I think that my reading of it is the reason why you're asking these questions is precisely why I said we've given them so much time. There is serious concern about gambling. You are, by raising the questions, not saying we condone the actions, but you're saying that if you want to normalize things, we think that it's important that we should engage with you vigorously on exactly how you are going to do that. So bear that in mind as you respond, please. Can we ask you to be as brief as you possibly can on the responses? Let's see if we can finish this by 25 past, which is in 15 minutes, after we've taken another round of questions.
No, thanks, sir. We will share this question in answering the question. But the first issue, I have forgotten the names of the Honorable, is it Honorable Sabat?
Yes.
Yes. The issue of public hearings. It is true that when we drafted the policy, we had to follow the processes of engaging with stakeholders and then coming to cabinet to seek mandate to go for wider public consultation. But the final arbiter, I had the word being used here, the final arbiter of policy making is that one of cabinet. Yes, cabinet is the final judge. So we went to all provinces. They said it is not enough. We went to communities, the provinces. I don't have a table here. Per province, I think we went in 3 or 4 communities per province, taking things from the ground together with LICA. The same unit is also responsible with LICA. We will deal with the LICA issue. Yeah. But there was a very wide consultation, but the decision has to be taken somewhere after consulting. So the decision has been taken to say gambling should be restricted. No new forms should be allowed. If a time comes in year X, let it be, but for now, let's emphasize enforcement as for now. So I'm talking to the issue of public hearings and the like, and then there will be a bill stage. This is the policy. There will be a bill. The bill, again, because it is own competence of provinces as well as the national. Therefore, even here, we will come here, you will divide yourself into the National Council of Provinces to go to provinces and you consult there, and then there is a mandate taken and the like. It will happen in this area. So that will be the rigor of consultation again at the bill stage before an act of parliament is passed. So the issue of unlawfulness. Yeah, if the Act says it is unlawful to kill, we take it as it is. And then the courts are there to interpret whether we are right or not, but the Act can say a person of underage is not allowed to gamble. It's unlawful. That's what we are saying. And then if it is taken to court to say no, it is not unlawful, it's another issue. I'm just reasoning the way how you put it to us, to say the courts are there really to pronounce. There are many sections in the Act that are unlawful, maybe that are unconstitutional, but as for now, they are not yet pronounced on. So life is going on. Unlawfulness, a minor, to be employed in the area of gambling, to be employed in the area of legal, is unlawful for a man. To enter into the outlet and drink is unlawful, as an example. But the act may say, the constitutional court may say, no, it's not unlawful. That we agree. That we are saying things of unlawfulness in the area of law. The act will say it is unlawful for a minor to be allowed to gamble. And then the other issue is on the internet gambling regulated instead of banning it, as an example. So we hope we understood the question. We are saying we have allowed other forms of internet gambling. The Shamaite will maybe elucidate on that. But we are saying other forms. We are saying no, we are not allowing them to be lawful for reasons already given. And then the issue of saying allow everything and just regulate, limit it here and there. We are saying that would be very dangerous because all the resources may go to regulating this phenomenon and it will be very difficult. So if we work with the intelligence, FICA, the banks, SARS, and then internet service providers to cut the internet gamblers, and then service providers to locate them and then deal with them, like in France. France is very vigorous on that. And if I'm not mistaken, Malaysia is also vigorous, a third world country. So we are saying we are also a third world country. Let's concentrate on maybe wanting to go to the moon, not on gambling. And then less restrictive, that's what we are saying. And then the board, Honorable Mtebe Mahigen. Okay. But people, no problem.
You have 6 minutes left.
Okay. So we are saying the policy council, the national policy, gambling policy council, it is there really for us to run business. This is the economy. We want the economy to run, by the way. We're not here to impede the economy. So we are saying, if business decisions are to be taken, and then people are not coming to the meeting, like in company law, what you do, if your holders are not attending meetings, but the company is to run, and then there is a tender maybe that they want to win, but shareholders are not coming into the then there is a problem. The economy won't run. So it is against this background that we are saying, let's run business, and then two meetings, no decision can be taken because of the quorum, then the third meeting, let's take a decision. It is done in company law, in the shareholding part of it. That is the rationale that is important to hear. Can you deal with the other issues?
Thank you, Honorable Member. Basically, unlawful winnings are where an under 80 person wants gambling. It is very clear. The ID requires that this person is under age. So that is an unlawful winning. So if there is any challenge, contention, he feels that he is more intelligent than 18, maybe he can go to court. Not that is there is head on us. They will actually activate. There is the process to exclude yourself from gambling. Not yet implemented, you will have a national register for that. There will be a tick of the person. So when you enter a casino, some of the protection, the question was asked, is that the casino and gambling venues have to employ somebody who will monitor people accessing the building. And in doing that, there are sometimes where you will meet an under 18 because he looks older to ask for the identity. But the person who has excluded himself or has been excluded will have a picture that will show this person is not supposed to be allowed. So all gambling venues in the country will have that. And then that is, if a person, that person manages to enter the system, then they win. Their winning is not due to them lawfully. So it's unlawful winning. If they have a problem with that, they will challenge it, and we will actually forfeit the money automatically. That's the rationale for us. National Gambling Policy Council is a forum of ministers and MECs. They are the ones with voting rights. So if there is no quorum because certain MECs were not in attendance, we are saying that we will allow that for two meetings. And the first meeting, the attending MECs and the minister should be able to take a decision. So the board will assist, because there will also be circulation of documents before attendance so that everybody can make input. So we will also be ensuring that all provinces' views are observed. So the attending ones, when he makes that decision, will also consider in that aspect as well. But we don't want to start giving the power to be decided outside the forum meeting in terms of the legislation expects that there should be a meeting for the forum to be set. And the issue of entrances to casinos. What we are talking about is like that structure of the carousel. They should be a fenced structure so that people can be walking into a casino. We are not just saying they should change the gate and everything, because there's a development that happens so they can circulate it. And there's a building like Monte Casino is just an envelope inside. So that's what we're talking about. Bookmakers, yes, they are there, and that's exactly why we think we should also enforce more about them and try to give more direction in terms of what they are doing in order for them to also do the line. The issue of social responsibility, normally the regulators will impose that in terms of license conditions to say you should contribute towards community social investment, like this, when the bookmakers are also not exempt of that, they also participate in that arena as well. The only difference is, unlike casinos, they don't have to build big structures like we see with the casinos. And bingo is a game of cards. The reason why it's called bingo is because the way they were playing traditionally, when they were winning cards, you would just scream bingo, and then that's why it became known as bingo. But it is just a game of cards, matching cards, and in terms of how you match them, you win. The challenge now has been that there is what we call electronic betting terminals. Electronic betting terminals now, you just press the button and then the machine matches the cards for you. The only difference of EDT and the normal slot machine in casinos is that EDT, you cannot play when you are alone. There should be another player, two or more players, to play. Because it's like the table one, there should be an interaction between the players. But this time the machine does the matching of the cards at the background. And then that's where we feel that it's just as good as a slot machine anyway. Yes, like I indicated, the gambling venues are obliged to have age monitoring personnel to look into that. But sometimes some beat the system because they look older, and they also avoid to be too intrusive when you are dealing with the people asking everybody entering. But maybe we might actually consider that. The issue of abused workers, we did not have them considered initially, because the issue of development of the sport was taken to be belonging to other departments. Because if we look into which department will have a role, there will be agriculture, there will be a department of sport as well. So some of them belong to where it should be agriculture, but none of the departments is actually going to looking into those issues. Now, for example, the grooms wanted to have an association that will speak for them in terms of how they are dealt with. For example, if a jockey rides a horse and that horse wins, they get an advantage. And then the grooms, if they also worked in training that horse and grooming it every day, the issue of percentage is not actually consistently dealt with. And even how they get the percentage, because normally some agree that we'll give 1%, but they give it to the trainer who will decide at their discretion how much they give to the group. So we feel that those are some of the issues that we need to deal with. And the issue of labor, yes, we will leave as the Department of Labor to address working together with us in terms of dealing with us, but it will be something that we will be able to impose in terms of license condition that we will deal with. And quickly, the issue of triple M is similar to Forex. It belongs to the National Credit Regulator and the Financial Services Board. We do not treat it as gambling as much.
Thank you very much. Honourable members, looking at the clock, I'm going to become unpopular. But you see, if you have ancestors, you have an advantage. So I've been warned by them to say that you're not going to have enough time. So I've asked these two colleagues to stay with us after the presentation so that if you have additional questions, you can take it up with them after we have closed the meeting formally. Because I think most of the main questions they have answered, I just wanted to emphasize that the point that was made that we're looking at regulating gambling and not banning it. The second thing is that we have very big concerns about this unlawful business. Now, I would have loved to engage with you also about the unlawful losers, because we need to look at that as well. And maybe say to a casino, if you have somebody who was unlawful, they came to gamble here and you took their money, then that money must also go to the NRG, which is a bit of a weird one. But we need to look at whether it doesn't make sense to also penalize those who allow unlawful participants in gambling. Then I would just want to say that we are mindful that this is, at this stage, policy position. It's going to come back to us as a draft bill under Section 76 of the Constitution, which would mean that we'll have to consult with the provinces. And that explains also, honourable members, the pressure that we are under now as lawmakers, that we needed to deal with the policy first before we can look at the bill. But in the same way, the next presentation that is before us has also been pleaded with us from the DTI to say deal with it now because there is an urgency. This IPAS has got to be signed by SADC during a meeting that's going to happen very soon in Botswana. So I'm asking with that explanation for your indulgence that we close the conversation on gambling now and go over to the presentation on the IPAS. What we would ask Nikki to do there, if it is at all possible, is to do the presentation within 20 minutes so that we give 20 minutes for the members to engage with you as well. Thank you very much, gentlemen. You are not leaving, you are just going somewhere to return. Over to you, Nikki.
Thank you very much, Jay. I'll try to be as quick as possible. Maybe just to say it's not that the agreement has been signed, it's been signed. The agreement has been ratified before a certain date for implementation, but I'll get to that in the presentation. We circulated a presentation, but I just want to highlight there was one of the mistakes in it that I corrected, but when I get to it, I'll mention it. So that presentation might differ a bit from the one that was sent. I'll just go briefly through the approach and negotiations that it follows, then a background on South Africa and European Union trade relations, a background on the IPA negotiations, and then the implications of the IPA, the improvements on the CDCA in terms of market access and sectoral provisions, and then South African EU graphical indications that cover in the agreement, the milestones, the way forward, and the conclusion. And just very briefly, in terms of the approach that we follow in trade negotiations, and it was also followed in the negotiation for the Economic Partnership Agreement, Our position is informed by and is aimed to support the national development objectives as they set out in the National Development Plan, the New Growth Path and the Industrial Policy Action Plan. The aim is, of course, to provide opportunities, increase export of especially value-added products. Also, what we negotiate should not unduly limit development policy space. We go through a very thorough national consultation process during the negotiations on our position at the intergovernmental level with other agencies, that the Department of Agriculture, SAS, and any other departments that might have an interest, as well as with business and labor in NEDLA, as well as in the Agricultural Trade Forum. Then we also have to consult in Tartu, because we are in customs union where Botswana, Lesotho, Swaziland, and Namibia, we have a common external tariff, so any negotiation, where we agree to tariff preferences, we have to agree at SAGU, so there's also SAGU consultations. That sometimes complicate issues because something that may be not sensitive to us as product may be sensitive to one of the other countries, and we are then not in a position to offer any preferences because the agreement is if a product is sensitive for any of one of us, it will be sensitive for all of us. And then also the main aim of the trade negotiation, another aim of course, is that it should support regional integration in Africa. Then the background to the South African EU relations. South Africa, the relations with the European Union has been governed by the trade chapter of the Trade Development and Cooperation Agreement. You will see in the slide it says trade and development, but trade, development and cooperation. So the agreement has got three parts. The trade part will be replaced by the FRDs going forward. The agreement was signed on 11 October 1999 and was implemented over a period of 12 years. It was fully implemented in 2012. The CTA was the first comprehensive trade agreement that South Africa completed with a developed country. And in terms of the tariff officials under the CTA, South Africa committed to grant duty-free access to 86% of the European imports in South Africa over a 12-year period. And that the phase down of the tariff was done in 2012, the full phase down. And then the EU liberalized 95% of South Africans' imports over a 10-year period, and their phase down of the duties were fully implemented in 2010. These tariff schedules and commitments in terms of the GDCA will go as is over to the EPA agreement. The GDCA provided some protection for sensitive South Africa sectors such as clothing and textiles, where no preferences were given or only a marginal preference was given. In terms of the CDCA, there was some problems with the CDCA in terms of South Africa's policy space in a number of areas. The CDCA, for example, do not allow us to impose any export taxes on exports to the EU. It also has a limited trade pass provision, and there was also a special provision that had an impact on our tax, but I'll get to that later in the presentation. The other big problem with the CDCA is that there's uneven market access in terms of agriculture, where South Africa got more access in agriculture than the EU gave to us. And those are issues that we wanted to deal with in the EPA. Then in terms of the South Africa state figures, the European Union as a bloc, so the 28 countries together, remain South Africa's main trading partner. The total trade increased from 374 billion in 2011 to 536 billion in 2015, an increase of 43%. South Africa's exports to the EU also increased from 151 billion in 2011 to 260 billion in 2015. And overall, the trade between the two parties has grown 257% since the agreement was implemented or entered into force in 2000. In terms of South Africa's exports, there is still a problem that is highly concentrated on primary products, our exports to the European Union, although in recent years there has been some changes. You'll see, this is a text from the slide that we provided previously, Platinum Zero Alloys, coal and iron ore are among the top 10 of our exports to the European Union, and it contributes a share of 13.2%, 4.8%, 3.6% and 3.1% respectively in 2015. And we want to move away from, of course, just exporting the primary products to more value-added products. But a good sign that we can see is that some manufactured goods are also counted among the top 10 South African exports in 2015 to the European Union. And in fact, our top exports to the European Union in 2015 were motor cars and motor vehicles for transport that contributed 21% of our exports to the European Union. And it was a tremendous increase for our exports of those products to the European Union in the last couple of years. Grapes, citrus and wine are also among our top exports to the European Union. Then background on the EPA negotiations. The Economic Partnership Agreement, EPA negotiations between the European Union and various groupings of the African, Caribbean and Pacific countries, it's called the ACP, these group of countries, started on in November 2002. The EPA was negotiated to replace the unilateral trade regime that was in existence between the European Union and the ACP countries under the Cultural Partnership Agreement and previously under the Lomé Convention. Now, South Africa did join the Lomé Convention or the fourth iteration of the Lomé Convention in 1997, and we also have a part of the Cotonou Agreement, but we were never part of the trade chapters in these agreements. But the unilateral trade preferences that were given by the European Union to these countries were not given to South Africa. Therefore, we had to negotiate the TCA agreement that came into effect in 2000. So our trade relationship with the European Union was always that we got preferences to them and they got preferences to us. So it was not a unilateral relationship like with all of the other countries. Under the international market access that's provided by the European Union, we're not in line with the WTO provisions, and therefore the WTO gave the EU a waiver until the end of 2007 to replace this arrangement, and that is why the negotiations was initiated in 2002. And the aim was for it to be finalized by 2007, but obviously that did not happen. Angola, Botswana, Lesotho, Mozambique, Namibia, South Africa, and Swaziland negotiated the EPA under the EU static EPA configuration. And initially, Tanzania was also part of this grouping, but they decided later to join the Eastern African Community in the negotiations with the European Union. South Africa initially only joined the same group as an observer country on the onset of the negotiations because we already had the TDCA. But by 2005, we had to review the TDCA in terms of the commitments under that agreement, and we therefore decided to rather join the EPA agreement and then negotiate under the EPA. It took a number of years to get agreement with the EU, but the EU finally agreed that we can join, and we joined the negotiations early in 2007. Our core interest has been to harmonize the trade regime between SAPO and the European Union. Because we are a customs union, we have to have a common external tariff, and we have to have a common trade regime vis-à-vis other countries. And also to secure further market access in agriculture beyond that was already provided in the CDA. And also, we wanted to claw back some of the policy space that was lost under the CDCA, as I mentioned earlier. In terms of the implications of the EPA, the EPA would ensure that SAPO's common external tariff are maintained through the uniform trade regime that we have agreed under the EPA with the European Union. We made an offer to the European Union, a common offer at SAPO. But of course, the European Union did not make a common offer in terms of tariffs to South Africa. They are giving to SAPO by giving duty-free quota-free treatment to the BRA, to the alcohol countries in SAPO. But South Africa has to negotiate line by line the tariff preferences that we will receive from the European Union. The negotiations also provided an opportunity for South Africa to address some of the CDCA shortfalls. And so I think there's already some of them. South Africa liberalized more lines than in comparison to the EU and August holder. The transfer clause in the TCA restricts tariff increases on EU goods, even for products that excluded from liberalization. So in terms of the adjudication, the 3rd of January 2000, when the agreement was implemented, we cannot increase any tariffs vis-à-vis the EU. Even if a product is not subject to liberalization, so it's excluded from the agreement, or even where we only gave a margin of reference, so we said we will give you a 40% preference in terms of the MSN duty. So if the MSN or 50%, say the MSN duty is 20%, you get a 50% preference, it means the EU must pay 10%. But then when that 20%, the MSN duty is increased, this could not increase the tariff vis-à-vis the EU. So they actually got higher liberalization than what was agreed. And the other issue was that under the EBA, there was a state bar provision. So because we liberalize duties, there can be an increase of imports coming in of that product, and that can cause some problems for the domestic industry. And then under the safeguard provision, you were able to impose a safeguard duty. So for a period of time, you can put a duty in place on that product. If you can tell there was a tariff of imports from the EU on this product, and it is causing damage to the domestic industry. But that provision was just in place for 12 years. So and 2012, that provision gone away, and now if there's a threat of import from the EU on any of these products where there's a tariff liberalization, then we are not able to impose any duty. So that was also a problem for us. And then, of course, as I said, we are not allowed to impose any export taxes on products exported to the European Union. In terms of improvement on the TCA, on market access, the economic partnership agreement that was finally agreed provided South Africa additional market access on 32 agricultural products, and it also allows market access in fishery products. And fishery products were initially was excluded from the TCA, so currently there is no liberalization of fishery products. But under the EFA, all fishery tariff lines will be liberalized, some immediately as ending in support of the agreement, and some over a period of 5 to 9 years. And this was something that our fishery industry has been looking for a very long time. There's lots of exports of fishery products that go to the European Union. And in terms of the new agricultural market access, the main new access is for sugar. Under the TPA, no sugar was access was allowed. The duties are very high in the European Union, so actually we cannot export to the European Union. Also, ethanol, duties very high, we can't export it to the European Union. So under the EFA, they will allow 150,000 tons a year of sugar to be exported duty-free, and also 80,000 tons of ethanol to be exported duty-free. So this is one of the major gains under the EFA agreement. There's also improved duty preferences for flour, some dairy products, fruit products, and other canned fruit products, and some jams and fruit juices. And then also one of the major gains under the EFA is that under the TDCA we were allowed to export about 30 million litres of wine duty-free to the EU. Under the EFA we will now be allowed to export 110 million litres. And this quota will increase by about 1 million liters every year, as long as the agreement is in place. So this is one of the big things in terms of market access under the EFA as well. In terms of the additional provisions improvement on the TCA, one of the big issues that we managed to agree under the EFA is that the rules of origin would now allow for extended formulations that can facilitate intra-regional trade and industrialization across the Southern and Eastern Africa region in particular. What this means in essence is that we can import the intermediate products from any of the African countries or Caribbean or Pacific countries and then use it as an input in a final product that we export to the EU, and that final product will then be able to use the reference in the European market. And this is something that will also be, help us to guide regional value chains and more value addition in Africa. Then on export taxes, the EU has agreed that we can introduce export taxes on products exported to the EU under certain circumstances. Basically, we can introduce a duty on each product at the time, at any given time. The duty can't be in place for more than 12 years, and the duty can also not be more than 10%. So that is the new agreement with the EU, that it allows us, I think, to have some duty.
Can I just interrupt that?
Yes.
You said exports to the EU.
Yes, this is the export tax, so it's a product that we export to the EU if we want to introduce
the
export.
The slide says from.
Oh, sorry. sorry. I'll correct that. It's exports to the European Union. My apologies. Then, in terms of the sanctions clause that I talked about, we were not allowed to introduce any new duties against the EU. All products that are excluded from liberalisation will also be excluded from the sanctions clause. So from now on, we can increase duties vis-à-vis the EU on those products. And also products that are only subject to a margin of preference, we would be able to increase the duties vis-à-vis the EU as long as the margin of preference is kept in place. So for example, on clothing products, the margin of preference given to the EU is 40%, and of the MFN, so if the MFN duty is increased, we would be able to also increase the duty on the EU as long as that 40% stays in place. Then we agreed a bilateral safeguard provision with the EU that will continue to apply indefinitely, and it will be applied for any product that's subject to liberalisation. So for all of those products, even under the TTA, if there is now an increase in imports from the EU and it's causing some problems in our domestic industry, we would be able to introduce a safeguard duty on that product for a period of 8 years in terms of this provision. And this provision will stay in place. Then we've also agreed that automatic specific agricultural safeguard on an agreed list of products. For this list of products, every year the imports reach a certain volume, a duty will become applicable. So it also provides some additional protection. And then also we agreed to single phase transformation for textiles and clothing, meaning that we would be able to import a textile or material that we use to manufacture clothing that we export to the EU. This was not allowed under the TDCA. We had to use material that's manufactured in South Africa for clubbing that we export, and therefore we will not be able to make use of the preference certification in the EU for clubbing, because we didn't meet the rule in many occasions. Then just an additional maybe that I did not include, but that I thought that I should mention, that the EFA also started to so-called new generation issues. That is intellectual property rights, public procurement, competition, and investment. And in terms of all these areas, we agreed to cooperation with the EU. And there's a provision in the agreement that if any of the parties wants to negotiate an agreement on these issues with the European Union, that they are able to do so, but not at this stage. And then in terms of services, the EU wanted to negotiate services. Botswana, Lesotho, Mozambique, and Swaziland has agreed to negotiate services with the European Union, but Africa did not agree. So we are not negotiating services with the European Union. The negotiation of services was not finalized by the agreement was finalized. So there's a vote in agenda in the agreement that will allow for these negotiations to continue to be finalized between those member states. And if South Africa and Lesotho want to negotiate, the agreement allow us then to negotiate services with the European Union. In terms of the geographical indications, South Africa and the European Union have a bilateral agreement, a bilateral protocol that forms part of the EFA agreement, in terms of which South Africa and the European Union will protect the various GIs the various geographical indications of each party in our jurisdiction, and it also deals and regulates the trade in wine and spirits. The protocol addresses the issue of protection of South African wine names exported to the European Union, and of course European names and wines that have been exported to us, as well as the protection of agricultural products such as Wimbledon, Tarulam, and Honeybussy. So this was a very big win for us. The protocol also provides for coexistence of names and therefore ensures that current South Africa uses of specific names like CETA. So in the future, we will protect CETA for the European Union into the South African market. But current users of CETA and some Vodafone users and some names in the South African market will be able to continue to use it. But no new users in South Africa will be able to use it, and we will also not allow export from other countries outside of the EU that wants to export those sort of products to South Africa. In terms of the agreement reached under the GIS on the names, the European Union shall receive protection on 251 GI names, which covers 120 wines, 5 beer, 20 spirits, and 106 agricultural products. And these agricultural products cover some speciality meats, such as some hams, and some cheeses, feta, some Gouda cheeses, olives, and so forth. And in South Africa, it has due protection on 105 GI names, which covers 102 wine names and 3 agricultural product names that I mentioned already. And then provision is also made that South Africa can add 30 additional agricultural product names in future. As we develop it in South Africa, we will be able to add it to the protocol. What this means is that for many years in the GGI has various, yeah, in America, but also in the European Union, in France, we had to spend a lot of resources to fight a company in France that wanted to register rooibos as a trademark. And what this will now mean is in future, no one will be able to register any intellectual property rights in the European Union for any of these names of South Africa that now protected in terms of the GRI protocol, unless the GRI user in South Africa agrees that they can register that. Then in terms of the milestones, the EPA negotiations were concluded and the process unfolded as follows. The EPA was initialed on 50 July 2014. We then went through a very rigorous joint and legal planning process that was concluded on the 21st of October 2015. And the EPA went through the various internal processes to get it ready for signature. It was signed by all of the parties except Angola, that hasn't signed the agreement. On 10 June 2016, and now of course it needs to go through the processes for implementation. For implementation, the institutions will be established for the proper implementation of the agreement, and we will have public awareness seminars with the civil society as well to inform them, and for the local industries and for exporters to inform them of the agreement and what it contains. In terms of the way forward, the European Union can provisionally apply the agreement while it's being ratified by all the EU countries, subject to approval by the EU Parliament. So the EU has also submitted the agreement to their Parliament now and already submitted to their Parliament. They will consider it in the beginning of September, I understand, for provisional application. If they need a provisional application, they will notify the depositors that they can provisionally apply the agreement, and then the agreement can enter into force provisionally for them, while all of the EU countries ratify the agreement. So it must go through the ratification processes in all of the countries before it can fully enter into force. But that's normally a process that takes many years. Under the CDTA, that process was only concluded, I think, 5 years after the agreement provisionally entered into force. And then for the current EPA countries, we will have to ratify the agreement before it can enter into force because we don't have provision for provisional application. The aim is for agreement to enter into force before the expiry of the European Union's duty-free quota free market access regulation on 1 October 2016 to guarantee continuous preferential market access into the EU for Botswana, Namibia and Swaziland. And therefore take the urgency of this matter. In terms of the agreement, once the last party has submitted either the ratification document all their documents saying that I could provisionally apply to the depository, the agreement will enter in force 10 days after that last deposit was received. And therefore, we all of us have to submit all of the documentation necessary for this process by the 21st of September, for the agreement to enter into force by the 1st of October, so that these three countries do not lose their duty market access into the EU. South Africa, of course, if it doesn't happen, can continue with our market access under the CCA, but many of our the new market access is quite, the industries is quite need for these to enter into force, or they seem for it to enter into force, so the sooner it can happen, the better it would also be for our own industry in terms of the new market access. Then in terms of conclusion, the EFA negotiations created an opportunity for SACO member states to comply with their obligations under the 2002 SACO agreement, which calls for member states of SACO to review or negotiate new state agreements together. The signed agreement provides an opportunity to consolidate SACO and its relations with the EU, and therefore the common SACO external standard will be preserved. It also enhanced quality space under the EFA vis-à-vis the CCA for South Africa, and it also allows for improved market access for South African agricultural products into the European Union. And that's it. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. 10 minutes of a time, but I think that was understandable. I think the last part that you presented was quite important. It wasn't in our notes, but it was important. Honourable members, we have had the presentation. Let us just remind ourselves that in terms of Section 2312 of the Constitution, this has to come to the committee. We approve it here, and we have to present it to the House and have all that done so that we meet the time frames that Ms. Kruger has explained to us in the presentation. So can I then now allow members to engage with the presentation? I have noticed Honourable Ntebe, Honourable Faba. Let's have the two of them, and then I'll add just a context question to them. Honourable Ntebe, you have the floor, sir.
Okay, I want to firstly agree that this agreement is quite special, and I will tell you why. EU is our biggest trading partner to date. We should be hitting around about 73% or 83%, if I remember well. But they are not only the biggest consumer of our primary products, but they are the biggest consumer of our raw primary products. And what we seek to do through this, if I hear you well, is to also make sure that there's beneficiation and value in before we can be able to do this. That I agree. But what is most dangerous out of this, if we don't sign the agreement, was the intention by the EU partners to try to take into the SAC members separate from the SADC arrangement. We are aware that they were trying to negotiate separately. I mean, South Africa is carrying the burden of all other countries, but they wanted to push other countries away from South Africa so that they can have different regimes of tariffs separate from this arrangement of SACO. And SACO has been an instrument since 1910 or something like that for us to be able to be developmentally in nature, but also to ensure that issues that are regional-based, they can be able to do. We cannot be able to do regional space development if we are not going to have to address issues of market penetration. But what we are looking to do, and I want to represent my fellow colleague from Western Cape, is that we have raised with the EU several times that scientifically and otherwise, there's no study that says the citrus fruit, the black spots were having any effect on them. And we have asked the EU to reconsider that issue. And I was hoping that it will appear in the agreement so that we know what we are doing. What we are seeking to do is that we are protecting 6% of our agricultural products. EU is protecting 106 products of their own. So if you go to one sector in EU which is the most protected, it's the agricultural sector. Then they are consuming our wealth from the Western Cape and all that. We are appreciative of that. But we would want to elevate South Africa and SADC as a whole to
a competitive level where we can be able to argue with them and be able to take. So that from one city, developmental and otherwise, this is a good agreement. It enables us to be a united bloc as we negotiate, but also to remain with a current regime that is necessary for us to be able to be developmental. Thank you.
Wonderful, Father. Chairperson, yes, as you see, this whole agreement is a thick and we got this, so there's quite a lot that we don't see, obviously. I just like to know, just like for information on the Brexit, what is the implications on that with this agreement as well? Because obviously when this agreement was gone into, the English were still, England was still part of it. So I'd like to know what the implications on this were.
Again, allow me to also raise my question to maybe a request that you also put this for us, if you can, within the context of what is the WTO implications on this. I know I have attended the Nairobi meeting on the WTO and recently the meeting in Geneva, and we've had some discussions. So, but I'm there to ask you to give it to us in a summary, but just so that we can also be privy to what's happening in the World Trade Organization. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. In terms of the, I don't think there was a question from Honourable Ngiri, but maybe if I can just comment on the issue of the CBX. I agree the agreement is developmental. If the agreement, the aim is that to assist us to export more value-added products, that is where we want to move to. And that's why, especially why this relation is so important, because it would enable us to be more competitive. If we can source wider for input products into our products that we export. And then in terms of the CBS, the agreement does deal with SBS issues. This is an SBS issue. It provides a framework in terms of how we will, if there's an SBS issue, how we will consult and how we will deal with it. And of course, it's put in the framework of our obligations in terms of the SBS agreement and WTO. So it didn't deal with CBS in specifics. It just dealt with how we will deal with SBS issues in regards to framework. So that is there, but the CBS issue we're already engaging with the European Union, and it's an issue that's already been raised in the WTO as well, and we are still trying to find a solution. It's unfortunately very difficult. As you said, the EU doesn't want to affect the science. They have their own science. They just had a new scientific view of CBS, and they're now saying they're even more convinced that it's a problem. So we will need to see how we will deal with that going forward. In terms of the issue of Brexit, yes, when we started to negotiate this, the United Kingdom was still fully a member of the European Union. The fact is today the United Kingdom is still a full member of the European Union. So when this agreement entered into force, if it enters into force on the 1st of October, it will enter into provisionally enter into force for all of 28 member states of the European Union, including the United Kingdom. So we will continue under the EPA to have access to the United Kingdom under the provisions of the EPA. But if the United Kingdom, and I know they will, we've had a number of consultations with them already to start talking about what we will be going forward. Once they give the Article 50 notification, that's a notification to the European Union that they want to exit. And we're not sure when that will happen. My sense is it will only happen next year. While they might be getting ready for them to negotiate, they will start to negotiate the exit out of the European Union, and they have a period of 2 years to negotiate the exit out of the European Union. And that will include also what they will do in terms of the trade agreement that they are part of as part of the European Union. So we don't know yet what will happen. They might decide to negotiate that they stay part of the of some of these agreements, but as an individual country. They may decide that they do not want to be part of any of these agreements, and they will negotiate their own agreements going forward. All they may decide that they want to join the European Free Trade area, we already have a free trade agreement with TIFTA as well. So I mean that's another option. So there's a lot of options or a lot of things that might happen going forward. We don't know yet what that will be and what the impact would be on the FBA. And therefore we are already, as I said, engaging with the UK. And we are staying in contact with them, and it says that if they go out of the European Union and got the impact on our agreement, we want our agreement with them to stay in place, so we need to start talking about what would replace it. So for now, I think that's just unfortunately all that I can say on it. Thanks for waiting for now.
Coming back to the WTO, but I didn't allow you earlier, I'll allow you now.
You see, the Kuwait concern is, I mean, we all obviously follow the Brexit, but what I need to understand, I understand that they are still part of the European Union. My question, though, is can they go into new agreements? Because you understand what I'm saying? Even though they are still part of the European Union, I don't know what the legislation for them will be, going into new agreements, because it will obviously be a brand new agreement. And this is my question, will they then be part of that? Because from what I understand, yes, they are still part of the exit strategy, which will take a 2-year period. But going into new agreements, this is actually what I was trying to understand, if they are allowed to go into new agreements, or if, because there was also talks from the previous Prime Minister that they will go into direct negotiations with other countries.
On the, because the agreement will be provisionally applied, but there is a decision made by the European Parliament that the agreement will provisionally apply. So once they make that decision and they notify the provisional application, that provisional application is in place for all 28 member states. So it's in place for European, United Kingdom as well. What will probably happen is then when the agreement goes to the UK for ratification, they may then decide what they want to do with it going forward in terms of ratification. But the provisional application will continue. And then by the time they, once they then decide to exit and they give the notification, my understanding is that you get that they feel that they can then start to engage countries bilaterally. But they will engage countries bilaterally, but they will still be held to the obligations under the European Union, including trade agreements, until the day they finally exit, formally exit out of the European Union. Then in terms of the WTO implications, in terms of the WTO, of course, you are allowed to enter into regional trade agreements. And Article 24 allows you to enter into free trade agreements as long as it covers the substantially all trade that this agreement does do. So it compares to the our obligation under the WTO. But I think that the issue is that what's happening in the WTO, and you'll see now, is that a lot of new issues is now starting to come forward. Intellectual property, to negotiate more in terms of intellectual property. And investment is becoming a very topical issue, and many countries in the WTO want to negotiate investment. They want to negotiate competition. They definitely want to negotiate public procurement. That our NSA has very clearly said we will not do. We will not negotiate public procurement. But these are all issues that's coming up in the WTO context, and where they want stricter regulations in the WTO on these issues. And what you also see in the mega regionals that are being negotiated, like the TPP between the European, between the US and the Trans-Pacific countries, and the European Union and the US trade agreements that they are negotiating, is that they negotiate on many of these issues, they are negotiating a lot of very strict rules. And they are upping the standards, and they want to bring all of that into, that they negotiate in their regional agreements, they want to bring that into the WTO. So from our side, in terms of the EPA, we said that we do not want to negotiate those areas, that we want to cooperate on those areas, and that for now that is also our position in the WTO. So what's happening in the WTO in terms of this agreement, it should not compromise our positions and what we are doing in the WTO.
Thank you very much, Nikki. Thanks very much, members. Can we, with that then, close that session of the presentation and go to the part where I need to request you as the Select Committee on Trade and International Relations after we have considered the request for approval by Parliament of the Economic Partnership Agreement between SADC and the IPA states on the one part and the European Union and its member states on the other part, that we recommend that the Council, which is the National Council of Provinces, in terms of Section 2312 of the Constitution, approve the said agreement, in which case I will then make a presentation as chairperson on your behalf to the NCOP for the ratification of the agreement by the Minister. Can I get an indication if there are any opposition to that? Or are we unilateral? We are in agreement. No, he doesn't say it to me here, but the Secretary reminds me I need to have somebody to propose and to second.
I'm proposing unanimous agreement.
Honourable Chairman, propose. Who seconds it? Honourable Mita, second. Thank you very much. There you have it. colleagues, just...
That agreement was benefit people in Zimbabwe. You know what Zimbabwe is? Pumalanga. I want to see it there.
Yes, I've allowed you to engage, Honourable Mtimunya. Can I just say, by way of a transfer into the next document, which is going to be the minutes of our last meeting, to say that, Honourable Members, about 15 years ago, I had the privilege to work with civil society lobbying, doing advocacy work in Germany. On nuts from. The point that I'm raising is very hurtful, comrades, members, that people in Mozambique could not export nuts packaged. They had to put it in plastic bags and export it to the European Union. And then we go to the supermarkets in South Africa and we buy these beautiful nuts that come from Europe, very tasty. They're actually from Mozambique. Mozambique could not get that. 5 times, double the price. So the significance of this EMAS is that within SACO, we have looked at it, but also within SADC, and said that this cannot continue. Let us put our heads together. And why I raised the question about the WTO is that in the WTO, we're acknowledging the point that you have made, Dr. Mateva, to say one of our biggest problems in Africa is that we are not united in terms of our policy positions on trade, and therefore we are losing a lot of added value and IPAS, as have been said in the introductory remarks of the presentation, is to must do that. I just thought I must get it off my chest. Thank you very much for proving that. Honourable Power, we must talk about it. I mean, a woman stood outside the hotel. I had something like 100 rand and I bought a whole bucket full of kitchen nuts. And I'm saying, this is so darn unfair.
There are no kitchen nuts in the States.
They have an interesting product there. And your dates. Have you seen the dates from...
They have only grapes.
I know you're married, you're not interested in dates anymore.
He only stops at home.
We have lots of things. I mean, our export of wines now to Thailand from the Northern Cape is a big deal. If we signed last year, Yeah, and now I understand that there's another country that's interested in online side. I can't remember who it is. Yeah. Honourable members, can I then divert us from that and present to you for approval, please, for adoption, the minutes of our meeting held on the 18th of May, 2016. On page 1, we have the members present, and notably absent was Honourable Anna McGuire from the EFF. Then, and still absent now, we have the names of the members of staff from the department that was there. We had an opening and welcome, and the proceedings was that the Deputy Minister highlighted the importance of the pillars of tourism, and then an official from the department presented to us the strategic objectives of South African tourism, not the Department of Tourism, South African tourism, and also the MTF estimates, and then the resolutions of the committee. The committee welcomed it, and we adopted the minutes of the last meeting. Can I get a proposal for acceptance of this? Honourable Farber, seconded. Honourable Long, seconded by Honourable Farber. That's the one. And next, members, is that we have
absentees appearing in the minutes. I don't see the name anymore.
Can I ask you to indicate when members are absent? Okay. Without apology, whatever record. Absolute without apology. Because we have apologies. No. Weston, it's a good thing you mentioned Honorable Kola, because I bumped into him now as I was coming here. He's attending a meeting of social development. But he was saying that he's got the advantage that we don't have. That he can be everywhere. And he was saying, what about your side, your oversight? Remember last time he went with us on oversight? Because it's his and end. Now on this thing, tourism is a big thing in Gilead, and that's why he came here. So now oversight now, I mean, he's talking between social development and this committee. But what we do with oversight is if we have alternate members, that we look at it beforehand and would look at getting them to be exposed to what we are exposed to in our side. Honourable Minister, second, the next point that I'm presenting to you is the third term program. You have a copy of it. It starts with today, where we had the briefing from DTI on the gambling policy and the IPA on the 24th of August next week. We're going to have a briefing by Durko on the African Renaissance and International Cooperation. Then we go on oversight. Then in September, we're having the revitalization of industrial parks. And you might remember yesterday that Honorable Mchimunya proposed that we have a discussion with DTI and the campus on this matter. But we didn't have this program before us. So we then consulted with Honorable Mchimunya, where we said, for the oversight, therefore, that part of the program that we agreed on yesterday, on, remember it was it's not Ekangala, Ekandastria, on Ekandastria and Bablesi, that we will not have it with DTI during the oversight, but warn them, please, when they do the presentation on that day, to particularly then also include in it Ekandastria in Babalehi. Then we go into our provincial week during 12 to 16th, and then 21st of September is a presentation by the Department of Tourism. Can I request that you indicate to me if you are happy that this be our program for the next quarter? Honourable Mchimunya, okay, everybody is okay. Thank you very much. Just the last thing then, Honourable Members, is the program for the provincial oversight. I know the only one that's seen it for the first time in a hard copy version is Honourable Law. Many of us have seen it yesterday. That what we have there, Honourable Members, is just on date
one Tuesday, that session 9 o'clock, 11 o'clock, will still be at the DGI campus to talk about the manufacturing, to get a briefing on the manufacturing industry before we go to the manufacturing sector. I'll come back to that now. The briefing by the National Lotteries Commission, the commission is requesting that we visit their offices. Now, their offices are 15 minutes drive, maximum. We can do it in 5 minutes, if you mean, from the DGI offices to the National Lotteries Commission. I was a bit worried when we said it is DGI, because I know Prof. Nabutando is the chairperson of the board, holds his African values very dearly. You don't come and visit me and I meet you at somebody else's house. You must come to my house. So he wants us to come to Hatfield, which is his opera. That's the one small change there. And then the briefing on the industrial park that we have here, we have earlier now, just now agreed we'll take that one. Then, honorable members, the visit to Rail Coaches Manufacturing Plant, that is not, I don't want us to go to the plant in Nigel. Nigel is like an hour's drive from Pretoria. There is a Rail Coaches Manufacturing Plant in Pretoria East, which is 10 kilometers from the lottery, because we'll have lunch at the lottery. Sorry, 10 minutes from the lottery. That's the plant we're going to go to. The one in Nigel, I don't think, is operating yet. No, the last time I checked with it, when we did our provincial oversight, it wasn't operating. And I spoke to the DG about that. It's not worth going back. Right. Because they most probably busy. The point that you registered about BMW, they most probably busy with the construction. Now, if tech or BMW, they are not only busy with the construction, they have advanced beyond that. So, just change that, honorable members, it will be Pretoria East. Then we'll visit the BMW plant, which will be like 20 minutes from Pretoria East. Are you not agreeing? But no, if we take the M4, but if we take via Avon, okay. But we say in terms of time, we have given ourselves half an hour from the one to the other. Then, honorable members, we're taking the HAL train this evening, so that you can take the HAL train at peak hours to see how it actually works, whether it is effective. Between Martins and us, we are trying to find a way in which you can deal with the luggage stuff. And to ask them to pay for it. We are going to ask the minister, the MEC for transport in the province, if he can, because it's oversight, that he accommodates us in that way. We're not just going to get into the station. We may want to get off, for example, if the MEC so wants, that we get off in Midrand. And just let the plane pass so that we see whether they actually sticking to their time schedule. I was impressed. Within 15 minutes, you have another train. Yeah, we, you caught that, man. That we may want to take a. Pretoria, Marlborough Airport, back to Joburg. That will also help us to get out of the 6 o'clock rush in Joburg. Apology from under the table. Yeah, okay. Then we'll just be able to propose more coaches. The next morning, we will have our breakfast at the hotel. We then travel from the hotel, Martins, Gold Reef City. And the interesting thing is that the gambling in there at Gold Reef City. So we may want to look at what we're talking about here. What I notice is that there's a lot of trading happening on the gambling floor. And I'm not sure whether it was legal or illegal trading. You know, they have that smoker section there.
Yes.
I didn't go to campus. I went to the smoker section.
Not yet. I want to know what things to say up there.
Not yet. But things is allowed. then we move to the offices of the MEC, or wherever he wants to meet with us, where we will then have we'll have purpose of the oversight, and then a briefing by the National Department of Tourism, and a briefing by the Gauteng Department of Tourism. And then we'll also have a briefing on Gauteng project. There are some things that affect us all over the country. I was looking yesterday at the taxi violence in Batam. Now, that comes on from before our democracy. And people are dying in the process. So I thought it's going to be important that we engage a little bit, because it's happening in Gauteng as well. Most of the taxis use the roads in Gauteng as well. So it's national and provincial. Then we will visit the Small Business Development Chamber in Johannesburg. Now, I just had it originally as a small business development project. Now, is there a chamber in Johannesburg? Oh, sorry, she's not here.
It should be. There's everything in Johannesburg.
Yeah. But okay, they are now talking about the chamber. I just thought that what we'll do is we'll go to whatever small businesses the Gauteng MEC for Economic Development is advising us to visit.
Mm.
So that we can see that the small business actually works. Then we get back to the hotel. The next morning, we will visit Extend the Public Works Project in and around Soweto. Honourable members, the rationale here is that we have 9 departments of government reporting to this joint select committee. And we're trying to get exposure to the work of all 9 departments. We couldn't. So we're having tourism, we're having DGI, we're having small business development, we're having transport, and now we're doing public works. So we're covering 5 out of the 9. This one we don't normally worry about, which is international relations. So we visit the EPW projects in and around Soweto, and we're also still consulting with the Department of Public Works on any other EPW projects that they think in the city, in and around the city. Remember, Johannesburg is a huge city. Ideally, let me be honest with you on this. Ideally, I thought that let us also meet with the new mayors. But it's not going to help us, because our meeting with them, the mayors are not there yet. They may be there within another 2-3 days. So you can't negotiate with the officials now on a program, and we needed to get this program sorted out. So we just decided, let's not get involved in that. Let's look at visiting the projects rather than the political heads. And then that afternoon, we're going to visit tourism sites in Soweto. I have had the appeal from very many of us saying, but we must visit Madiba's house. We will do that. Madiba's house and Archbishop Desmond's house is in the same street. We will do that. The Hector Peterson Memorial is within walking distance from that. We will visit that. But then there is also Mara's Kitchen. I see you, Honorable Lawn, digging your lips. They have the nicest beer that you drink out of the bottle. The next day, Honorable Members, I would plead with you, please, let us not organize our schedules so that we are not there on the last day. It happened the last time, and it was very embarrassing for us as members of Parliament. On the last day, we go to Park Station. And we will just look at the environment around Park Station. People from Northern Cape, Eastern Cape, Northwest, all come to Park Station. Is there space that the Department of transport is responsible for the conducive, for the safety, for whatever else, for these people who we serve. And then we've asked because what is happening, honorable members, is many of our big cities in the world are becoming dilapidated. Now, I live in Johannesburg. I've seen it happen from the time that I had to walk on the other side of the road to where I can walk any side now where there are no construction work happening. So we will look at some East EPW projects and we'll confine it just around the bus station area. That area has changed drastically in the last 10 years. Mm-hmm. Developments around bus station, terrible developments outside. If you go, for example, to St. Mary's in the church, you know, where people are urinating on the walls of the church. You see, so the good and the bad of the development of a city. Then we will allow you to disperse and leave at 12. Martin will make sure that he does not book any ticket before 13:30 so that you can be in time for your flights. Can I get an indication from you members if you are happy with this program? Is there anything you want to add or subtract? Are we all fine? Thank you very much. We will continue with the details thereof. Honourable members, we want to thank you for your time. We know that we've gone much longer than yesterday, but appreciate it. We will meet again next week, Tuesday.
Are you okay?